It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, former U.S. Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez joins us with his conservative and compassionate approach to immigration reform.
But first, it's time for our weekly review of state news.
Michael Leland, WPR News Director, joins us now for the top stories around the state. Michael, thanks for joining us.
Nice to see you, Rob.
Well, some of the big news, and there was some of it this week, the latest on this ongoing saga of what happens to the university system in the budget. Not the money side so much, but management. What do we have as the latest today?
Right. This is more policy, and the University of Wisconsin Board of Regents today has voted to change how tenure for UW faculty is treated. Right now, it is actually part of state law, and that makes Wisconsin the only state in the country that has tenure written in to its laws. The change proposed by Republicans in the legislature and the governor is removing UW tenure from state law and then transferring control of it to the UW Board of Regents. Now, the regents say they do plan to back tenure as a UW policy even without the state law, but the controversy is that some members of the board also added language that would have a task force look at the possibility of allowing layoffs that are not due to fiscal emergencies. Right now, tenured faculty can be laid off if there's a fiscal emergency or for cause, but this new policy would call on a task force to look at expanding that ability to lay off faculty for what it's calling things like budget or program decision reasons.
So right now, none of this is exactly a done deal.
Right.
This would empower the regents to set the new course.
Right. They do say they want to set that new course. In fact, UW System President Ray Cross is saying that this task force that they're talking about will have a lot of faculty members on it, and he believes that tenure protections can be kept in place, but a lot of faculty members say they're not so sure. Some of them had said it would make it easier for the UW system to fire them for any ideas that they share in the classrooms that might be controversial. Several UW system faculty members attending yesterday's Board of Regents meeting in Milwaukee were silently in the back of the room with blue tape over their mouths. They said it showed that they could be silenced without tenure protection.
And there's worry. A lot of professors in particular and some others have raised the concern that this could affect who the university can get and keep in the future.
Right. They are saying that this could hurt the UW by causing some faculty members to leave the system and could also make it more difficult for the system to attract some of the new faculty that it wants and needs in the year ahead.
Okay, another long-awaited item came out yesterday now. A deal reached, again, not a done deal,
right,
on the Bucks Arena.
Right. The governor, Milwaukee's mayor, other local leaders and officials of the Bucks announced the latest plan to build a new arena for the Bucks in downtown Milwaukee. This one calls for public financing of half of it, $250 million plus interest. And the Bucks would contribute not only the other $250 million, but also agree to cover any cost overruns that inevitably pop up in construction projects.
And this has been the sticking point, how much public money is going into this and where it's coming from, state versus local. So what do we have in this deal as it stands?
In this latest proposal, the state would issue about $55 million in bonds. Milwaukee County would turn over responsibility for collecting millions of dollars in uncollected debt to the state, so there's potentially more money coming in. The city of Milwaukee would build a parking garage, and also the Wisconsin Center District, the convention area of the city, would issue about $93 million in bonds to help pay for the new arena.
Now, you've got former opponents Scott Walker and Tom Barrett on the same page on this, the county executive as well, Republican legislative leaders. Usually you line up names like that, it's just going to happen. Maybe not this one, though.
Not so much this time. We got to this point, of course, because a lot of lawmakers in both parties said they weren't happy with the governor's original proposal of issuing $220 million in bonds to pay for the new arena. This latest proposal still needs to get approved by the state legislature. It's not clear whether the votes are there to pass it. There's also the possibility that this could be taken out of the budget altogether and considered separately, which would mean it could be months before this is wrapped up. And the governor says he doesn't care if it's part of the budget or not, as long as it gets approved.
And the concern from everybody at this thing yesterday was, if we don't do something, we might lose the team. Give us a little background
on
that.
Right. There's sort of a ticking clock in the background, a shot clock, if you will.
Very good. Well done,
you like that?
Yes,
yeah, basketball
like that
reference there.
Thank you.
So the Bucks and the state have been trying to work out a deal to pay for this new arena because the NBA has said that it's giving the team until November of 2017 to have a new arena under construction, or the league has the option to buy the team and possibly move it to another city. Now, the reason is the Bradley Center was built in 1988, which isn't real old, but it really makes it one of the oldest NBA arenas in the league. It's considered pretty antiquated. antiquated by professional sports standards because it doesn't have enough premium seats and doesn't have the other things that stadiums are using to generate revenue. So they feel that a new stadium will bring in a lot more money, and that's why the league is leaning on the Bucks to build a new home.
So it goes to the legislature next, one way or another.
Yes.
We are talking to Michael Leland in our weekly roundup of Wisconsin news. Transportation funding, another sticking point in the state budget. What's new there?
Right. Another ongoing disagreement between some Republicans in the state legislature and the governor. The governor wants to issue bonds for major road projects in the state. Republicans in the legislature say they're not comfortable with that level of borrowing, which would amount to about $1.3 billion.
And we've heard a lot of alternatives, raising gas taxes, user fees, that sort of thing. Not really on the table, it seems.
Right.
Like.
The governor has said lots of times he's not going to agree to raise the gas tax or the cost of vehicle registration. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss has said that he would support raising the vehicle registration fee as a way to raise money for transportation projects. But again, Governor Walker said that's a non-starter.
So absent that, Speaker Voss says maybe no borrowing at all.
Exactly. He says if there's no new money coming in, maybe we shouldn't be borrowing money either. And other Republicans have discussed other options, including reducing the amount of transportation bonding in the new budget by between $300 and $800 million. That would be down from the governor's proposed $1.3 billion.
So the logical extension there, no money for construction projects. I assume that means you dial back on those construction projects. Is that what's being suggested, maybe threatened here?
Yes, it could mean delaying some big projects around the state, including one very important in southeast Wisconsin, rebuilding that zoo interchange west of downtown Milwaukee. Also plans to expand the I-3990 corridor from roughly the Wisconsin Dells area down to the Illinois state line. That could be delayed as well.
So this and the arena deal are sticking points in the budget. Could delay final approval, I guess, later than they had hoped.
Right. It is, and the talks are continuing behind the scenes. Now, the Joint Finance Committee had hoped to have its work on the budget wrapped up by today. Obviously, that's not going to happen. In fact, the panel still hasn't scheduled its final meeting. I'm hearing this morning that they might not even meet next week, although that could change. The budget still needs Assembly and Senate approval once the Joint Finance Committee completes its work. So,
still watching.
Got till the end of the month to finish a new budget because the new fiscal year starts July 1st. It may happen in time, but it could be tough too.
Michael, thanks as always.
Have a great weekend.
That was WPR News Director Michael Leland. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
For a nation of immigrants, the U.S. has found it difficult to formulate immigration policy. From the beginning, policymakers have grappled with how to attract enterprising newcomers and still maintain law, order, and opportunity for U.S.-born citizens.
Former U.S. Attorney Alberto Gonzalez says federal policymakers have failed to strike this delicate balance, leaving state and local jurisdictions to take matters into their own hands, and he's offering up a new plan.
Alberto Gonzalez is with us now, former judge and attorney general of the United States. He's co-author of A Conservative and Compassionate Approach to Immigration Reform. Judge Gonzalez, welcome to Central Time.
I'm happy to be with you.
So this is a technical legal issue. It's also got some personal resonance for you. I imagine you're the grandson of immigrants from Mexico. How have immigration laws, or lack thereof in some cases, affected your family history?
Well, as you indicated, three of my grandparents were born in Mexico. Now, this may surprise you, but I'm not really sure whether or not they came into this country legally or not. And I've tried to research this, and obviously was asked this question several times when I was the Attorney General. But be that as it may, you know, we're a nation of immigrants, I think that we're also a nation of laws, and that's what we got these two principles that we have to somehow accommodate in order to deal with immigration. And in this book, we try to set forth, when I say we, myself and David Strange, who is a lawyer from Texas and does a lot of immigration work, we try to set out an approach which we, as the book says, probably has a little something for everyone to hate. We try to set out an approach that is both conservative and compassionate, and also one that's very comprehensive.
We'll get into some of the details of your plan, but you know, Congress has been wrangling over this issue for a long time, multiple presidents. Why has it been so hard to implement a viable immigration policy?
I would say there are probably two reasons. One, because there are so many constituencies that have an equity in the outcome of this discussion. some of them are very powerful, and it's been hard to accommodate the desires of these constituencies. And of course, the other reason is because this has also become very politicized, and we're now entering into the silly season, presidential season, and whether or not, I mean, I have no expectation that anything's going to be done in the next few years, but I am hopeful that this book will sort of generate questions. I'm hopeful that the media, people like yourselves, when you have the opportunity to question the candidates, ask them, you know, what do they propose? How are we going to solve this? Because in a post 9/11 world, we have to know who is in this country and why. And I think the right immigration policy will help our national security in addition to helping our economy, and I truly believe that if we do it the right way.
Well, I want to get into your proposals now. As you say, we're a nation of laws and a nation of immigrants. You're trying to cover both of those grounds. Let's start with the nation of laws side of it. What kind of efforts do you want to do to make sure laws are obeyed, security is upheld at our borders?
Well, we've done a pretty good job since 9/11 in making the border more secure, and we've done so through additional fencing, through the advances in technology, through the deployment of additional border agents. But I think that we ought to continue to look to see what more that we can do to discourage people from coming into this country at the border. But as I say, I think we've made significant progress. I think that we also need to look at our visa process. Over half the people that are here unlawfully came to this country lawfully. So no matter what we do at the border, in terms of securing the border, that's not going to solve that particular problem. So we need to figure out a way that we can make home countries more accountable, employers more accountable, universities more accountable for people that come and study at the universities or work at a company and then simply disappear. So the visa A revision or a visa process is one that I think is also very important. And In addition, I think we need to look at tougher workplace enforcement. This is not simply a problem that can be solved by going after the immigrants who break our laws. We also need to be more diligent in prosecuting employers who break our laws.
And on the nation of immigrants side, you try to make the case that, as you said, we are a nation of immigrants, that immigrants can have a value in this country. So how does your plan recognize that? How do you make an inviting path that that brings the benefits of immigration to the United States?
Well, we look at the 15 million or so that are here unlawfully. We believe that the notion of deporting 15 million people is unreasonable. I was involved in discussions in the White House where we considered this. We concluded it was impossible, could not be done by the federal government. But even if we were successful in doing so, it would be devastating to certain industries where these immigrants are a large part of the workforce. What we need to do is to try to develop a system, in my judgment, that identifies those who qualify, meaning those who can provide for themselves, those who don't have a criminal record. Those who qualify, we put them in some kind of legal status. It could be a temporary one. It could be a permanent one that may or may not lead to citizenship. That's a debate we can have at some other time. But we need to put them in some kind of legal status. And at that point, you know, then I don't have a problem if they want to go down to the DMV and get a driver's license. But today, I have a problem with having someone who's here unlawfully being able to walk into a government office and take advantage of government benefits. So we put them into some kind of legal status, and they pay taxes. They'll pay back taxes. It will probably have them pay a fine. And that way, all this talk about amnesty really should go away.
Talking to former Attorney General of the United States, Alberto Gonzalez. He's co-author of the new book, A Conservative and Compassionate Approach to Immigration Reform. Now, some, especially Republicans in Congress, have said, you know what, we're not going to get a grand bargain on immigration. Let's take this one step at a time. Let's do border security first. Then we can talk about possible paths to citizenship. Do you think that kind of piecemeal approach could get to where you want to see us go?
I think it's unlikely. Obviously, it's better than the status quo. But here's my concern. Let's say that there's an attempt to do this in a piecemeal fashion. because Republicans control both houses of Congress, I think it's fair to assume they're going to first focus on border security. And once we achieve border security, then they say that they'll start looking at visa reform, they'll look at workplace enforcement, so on and so on. My concern is, given the history that we've seen from Congress recently, that they're not going to have the courage to take tough multiple votes on immigration reform, and that you're going to have some people who really are who really just care about border security. Once they pass that first bill and they feel like they've done a lot to secure the border, they're going to simply wipe their hands and say, you know, I'm not interested in any more immigration reform. I've done everything that I believe needs to be done. And that's the concern that I would have. The other concern, related concern, is I fear that they would pass a bill that has border triggers that are so unrealistic that the other portions of necessary immigration reform that we never get to. I know it's much harder, but I believe a better approach is to deal with this in a comprehensive fashion so that we have all the constituencies at the table. Everyone knows what they're going to get. Everyone knows what they give up. No one's going to get everything that they want. That's just the way this thing has to work. I think that's a much better approach. But if you're giving me the option between nothing and trying to do this piecemeal, then I would have to do a piecemeal. But I continue to believe that's not the right way to go.
But as you said up front, there's something in what you've said here for everyone to hate. If everybody's at the table, some of these elements are going to be a poison pill. Any legal path to citizenship, some people say, no, that's effectively an amnesty. They won't want it because of that. The other side will have their objections. How do you get everybody at the table to get everybody in Congress to agree on something this controversial?
Well, I think that, for example, someone who believes that these individuals should become citizens at some point, may be more willing to allow for tougher border security if they can get additional legalization for immigrants. The point is that there's going to be a lot of trading here, and I just believe it's just more likely that we'll get a more effective solution if we do this in a comprehensive fashion. And you're right. No one is going to get everything that they want because this touches so many. This tree has so many branches, but it's that complexity. And this may seem somewhat paradoxical, but I think that complexity requires this be done in a comprehensive fashion. Whether or not this Congress has the will, the courage, the talent, the leadership, whether or not they have the same kind of qualities coming from the White House, that remains to be seen. But again, this is our proposal in this book.
So as you say, the options are do a big grand bargain, do something piecemeal, or there's the option of nothing happening. What happens? What are the consequences of the status quo going on for years?
Well, there's all kinds of possible consequences. One, if we continue to have a border that's not as secure as it should be, and we continue to have evolving threats around the world, it's possible that someone with ISIS comes to our southern border and conducts another 9/11 type attack. So that's one possibility. Another possibility is you have a additional influx of undocumented immigrants on our southern borders. They have an obligation to provide for their education. People are losing their jobs in those states. American citizens losing their jobs, and all of a sudden, these states feel just this terrible obligation. The state leadership, understandably, feel like they need to do something to address this issue. They start passing additional laws. The Supreme Court steps in and says, "Wait a minute! This is a federal. This field has been federally preempted, and only the federal government can regulate in this area." And so, the states are left without any kind of relief. So, you know, This is clearly a federal function, and it's high time the federal government deal with it in an effective and comprehensive way, in my judgment.
And since you've written this, are you hearing responses from people in the community, maybe people in politics who are saying, yes, we need to do this, we need to do something like what you're proposing?
Quite candidly, I think that people, if they can avoid talking about immigration reform during this campaign cycle, I think they're going to do so. I think they understand how hard this is, which is disappointing. I know how hard this is. I've been involved in the highest levels of our federal government in making tough decisions. This is why people are elected to serve. This is why people are appointed to serve, to take on this kind of these kinds of problems. In my judgment, the whole immigration debate is symbolic of what is wrong in Washington in terms of things becoming politicized. So to answer your question, I don't know what the reaction is going to be, but we felt an obligation, given our experience and our background, to lay out a framework. Many of the things that we talk about here are not terribly new, but we try to repackage it in a way we were hopeful would be attractive to additional members of Congress and perhaps the administration. And if not to this Congress or this administration, perhaps to the next Congress or the next administration, to look at this and make decisions that will move this debate forward.
Judge Gonzalez, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That was Alberto Gonzalez, former U.S. Attorney General under President George W. Bush and Dean of the Belmont University College of Law. He's the co-author of the new book called A Conservative and Compassionate Approach to Immigration Reform.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
Whatever generation you're from, millennial, Generation X, baby boomer, greatest generation, you've probably heard yourself described in a certain way as having distinctive traits, personalities, work attitudes, maybe, all based on the era you grew up in. Like these guys in the movie Reality Bites, Ethan Hawke and Winona Ryder in the defining movie of my generation.
You see, lady, this is all we need. A couple of smokes, a cup of coffee, and a little bit of conversation.
The coffee drinking, smoking, talking Gen Xers. I actually never saw that movie.
It's a really good movie.
Yeah.
You should see it. Well, there are a lot of stereotypes like that in pop culture, and plenty of consultants ready to explain how the generations work, shop, and act differently.
Just one problem. According to our next guest, it's all pretty much rubbish. Rebecca Onion joins us now. She's a cultural historian at the University of Ohio and history writer at Slate.com. We've got a link to her piece on Eon.com called We Need to Ditch Generational Labels. We've got that linked on the Central Time Facebook page. Rebecca, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
So what kind of things do we think we know about these different generations? What kind of claims are being made about them?
Well, as you sort of mentioned, there's a sort of raft of generalizations about the way that generations have collective personalities, sort of the idea that, the greatest generation is sort of brave and stalwart, and boomers are transcendental and psychedelic, and sort of like outward thinking, that Gen Xers have, some kind of problem with authority, maybe, depends on who you ask. And then, of course, the millennials were the people that, it seems like the youngest generation is always the one that people want to talk about the most. So there's sort of a bunch of generalizations about millennial entitledness or laziness or, addiction to social media, you name it.
And you say that a lot of these labels are kind of vague. They're not much more useful than a horoscope. You can kind of read yourself into any of them. Is that, though, what makes them stick, that they are so vague?
Oh, I definitely think so. I mean, I think it's really fun to self-define. I mean, I enjoy reading horoscopes and thinking about the ways in which I am and am not a Libra. And for the same reason, I sort of, I'm like a borderline Gen X, Gen Y person, and I enjoy thinking about the ways in which I might or might not be like that. But I think I have a problem with it when it comes to, a label like that sort of influencing the way that you think about other people or the way that you would treat a group of other people or the way that you would approach them when it comes to public policy or business or education. because it's so general.
Yeah, so unlike a horoscope, businesses are using these labels or trying to. There are consultants out there for marketing, for managing personnel. What kind of claims are made about how useful, how important these labels are in a business setting?
Well, I think huge claims, and it's you know, there's a lot of money being paid. There's a lot of money in it, I guess, if you are a consultant who will talk about how to reach different generations or how to categorize generational personalities. I think because, you know, people are desperate to especially sell to young people, there is a special market for talking about millennials and what they might want or what they might do. And I just think, you know, there's such a we have such a diverse society. If you think about it for 2 seconds, becomes evident to me that there are as many groups of millennials as there are groups of people in general, and that each of them is experiencing the special things that are happening to their generation in different ways.
Are there any aspects of this, though, that might be true? Say, if you look at an absolute metric, like millennials, more millennials buy mason jars than Gen Xers. Would that be something if you look at a hard number like that?
They love their mason jars, these kids
Supposedly
today.
Supposedly they do. I do not make this up. Well, it might be. But anyway, what do you think about if you look at a hard number?
Yeah, no, I mean, I don't have necessarily a problem. I mean, I think there's like a... there's a reinforcement that happens with that, right? Like there are some numbers like that, but then they're sort of bandied about as evidence to direct, you know, future business activity. So there's a chicken and egg effect in some way. And I don't know. I mean, I think there are some things about the concept that make intuitive sense. So in my piece, I wrote about, for example, the idea that, you know, a generation that experiences a war, you know, a generation, so say you, say instead of talking about a generation, I like to use the word cohort instead, which is what sociologists use, which is sort of a more defined group. So, for example, the historian Robert Wool, who writes about the effect of World War I on Europeans in particular, he talked about the effect of World War I on British elites. So already he's like sort of narrowing and defining what happens. But, you know, once he's narrowed and defined, he is able to find some interesting things out about the way that, you know, participating in that war or seeing that war happen changed people's minds about things. But in order to do that, he has to look at a really small group of people and acknowledge that he's looking at a really small group of people.
Talking to Rebecca Onion, talking about generational labels, things like millennials, Gen Xers, things like that. She says they're not that useful, hard to make generalizations about these big groups. It seems sometimes, Rebecca, when I see statements made about a group of millennials or Gen Xers, whatever, it's talking about implicitly white, middle-class, educated members of that generation, and not anyone else necessarily within it. Do you think that tends to be what the implicit assumption is there?
Definitely. I mean, I think that's one of my biggest issues with it. I don't think that, you know, the idea that millennials are entitled, which, you know, I feel like is a very handy thing to say if you're mad at people who are young in some way. But you know, there's just so many people who don't feel that way, who, you know, are, you know, young people who are growing up without advantages or who don't, you know, who don't have parents necessarily who are pushing them to do things, so they're not participating in this, like, programmatic youth culture that is another supposed, you know, characteristic of millennial life. And that is definitely a definition that focuses on sort of the privileged or the white or the wealthy in a way that excludes a lot of people, I think.
Well, another thing about these labels, it seems to me that they're largely negative traits associated with anything, and so it seems like it's become sort of an encoded way to criticize people older or younger than you are.
Yeah, we love to do that. yeah, I mean, I think there is a definite nostalgia to it, and, you know, it is interesting. I do feel like there's been a lot more criticism. I mean, you know, this is vague, but I feel like I spend a lot of time on the internet, and I feel like I see a lot of millennials criticizing baby boomers, for example, you know, criticizing upward, basically, instead of criticizing downward, which is the way that it usually seems to go. But there is definitely a, like an us versus them sort of attitude to it.
And going in the other direction, the sort of the what's wrong with kids these days, another problem you point out is that these generational labels can lead us to ignore other factors, like millennials get called, you know, maybe lazy for not getting jobs. Well, maybe they're not getting jobs because there aren't jobs out there. It's a bad job market. Yeah. And we overlook that if we just try to make generalizations.
Yeah, it's about, I mean, you know, there's a writer that I quote, Malcolm Harris. You know, he writes, he's a millennial who writes a lot about this kind of thing. And his argument is, you know, rather than looking at some vague idea of personality or archetype, like we should be looking at the structures that define people's lives. So, you know, if you are an older person who would say something like, oh, well, why do people have, you know, student loan debt? I worked during the summer to put myself through college. There are hard numbers you can look at that show how much more difficult that would be to do today. You know, and in fact, for some colleges, it would be, you'd have to have a really lucrative job, possibly an illegal one, to make that happen. So, yeah, looking at those numbers puts it in perspective in a way that thinking about personality traits doesn't really do.
We're talking right now to Rebecca Onion about generational labels, things like baby boomers, the greatest generation, Gen X, and millennials. She says there have been a lot of generalizations about differences between those generations, but she says the labels aren't really that useful.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you see differences between generations, maybe in your family or at your workplace? Do you feel like these labels overstate the case, that there are more differences, say, within a generation? And which of these groups are you a part of? Do you think the stereotypes you've heard actually fit your reality? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. We continue our conversation with cultural historian Rebecca Onion, looking at generational labels, things like, you know, Gen X, millennial, baby boomer. Our guest says these labels, the generalizations people attach to them, don't really tell us much, and we should stop using them.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you feel like you've been misrepresented or unfairly judged because of the generation that you're a part of? Do you think these labels are useful? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll go to our callers. We've got John on the line in Milwaukee. John, hi.
How you doing, sir?
Good. What do you think?
I don't think labeling things as a can sometimes be a good thing. But as far as the if it's a personal attack or something like that, that's one thing. But it's I'm Catholic. My wife and kids are Native. There's a lot of things that people say about Catholics, a lot of things that people say about Natives. But if my actions and my behaviors show that we don't fall into some of these stereotypes or some of these things that people would bash, those actions are changing it and maybe giving those other people different perspective on how to look at things rather than boo-hooing about it. Because that's how it seems with a lot of people of different generations, and I'll say with this younger generation, there's a lot of kids that are boo-hooing about it, but they're not doing anything to really make a change or are actually living those stereotypes.
Gotcha, John. Thanks a lot for the call. So millennials in particular, you're saying if they're not happy with these labels and stereotypes, live outside them and demonstrate something different, I guess he's saying, Rebecca.
Sounds like it. I mean, I think that there are some cases in which that definitely works. There is a personal one-on-one relationship you have with people in the workplace or people in your family that might change your opinion. But I also think there's a way that it seems to me that sometimes with these stereotypes, they're useful in some way. And it seems that people aren't that rational, I fear. Maybe they are in some cases, but it seems like you know, there are some ways in which the adoption of a stereotype like this is something that's convenient for people to carry out. So, for example, if you're marketing to millennials, it might be easier just to sort of lump them all together than to try to say, well, you know, actually, I know someone who is 17 and doesn't have access to the internet at all, so I'm going to be different in the way that I think about it. Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you for the call, John. Yeah. We're going to move next to Josh in West Bend. Josh, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good, thanks.
Hey, so I guess my thought on this is the whole labeling thing is just another way to divide us as a society. I see a lot of this divide and conquer kind of stuff, and I just feel like the labeling of the generations is another way of doing it.
All right. Well, thank you for your thoughts there, Josh. And Rebecca, do you think these are ultimately divisive, maybe actually causing real harm?
I mean, you know, this is obviously my personal opinion, but I agree. I mean, I think that there's especially maybe sort of economically, there's a lot of, especially, you know, the stereotype that millennials don't work hard. I do think that there are ways that stereotype works to keep us from thinking about the actual economic situation that they're in, which is obviously our economic situation too. You know, they don't live in a separate economy. And so I think this point is well taken, that there are ways that thinking about it as a stereotype keeps us from thinking about ourselves as a unified situation, unified society.
Talking to Rebecca Onion about generational labels. We've got an article she wrote on the topic over at the Central Time Facebook page. She says terms like millennials, baby boomers, and the assumptions that we carry along with them really do maybe more harm than good. And something that surprised me, Rebecca, reading your piece is I thought this is a fairly new thing, that recent generations came up with this stuff. You trace this backwards. We've been making these labels and assumptions and pushing back against them for a couple centuries now.
Yeah, people started talking about this in the late 19th century in Europe. You know, actually, there's historians and writers who sort of made it their intellectual project to think about it. And this happened a lot because they're so confused by all the revolutions going on and the turmoil in their cultures and societies that they were trying to figure out how to understand it and categorize it. There's an article that I mentioned in the piece that was written in the 20s that already has a huge bibliography of people talking about what it means to be in a generation. So we've been talking about it for a while now with no conclusions.
We're going to go back to our phones now. We've got Steve on the line in Maquoneago. Hi, Steve.
Hi, I was calling. I've been reading some of Jean Twenge's work on Generation Me, where she does a lot of statistical work on characteristics and attitudes of millennials and so forth. And there seems to be a lot of evidence that there is profound differences in way of thinking about the world and attitudes and approaches. And as our speaker, I'd like to know what she thinks about that, because it seems to be kind of compelling. And if the whole business world does orient itself around the fact that different age groups and different peoples have trends, there must be some truth to it. What we do to it and to what extent we do something with it we might debate, but that there's some basic truth to it seems to me to be well documented.
All right. Well, thank you. Appreciate your call, Steve. And Rebecca, is there some truth, you know, amidst the things you have difficulty with, is there some underlying truth in these generational differences? Maybe some demographic things that are clear to see if you look at the numbers?
Yes. I mean, I think with any, I haven't read the book that the caller referred to, and I'm looking at the webpage right now, but it looks like I haven't looked at the survey that she used, so I can't assess whether or not it seems you know, methodologically correct. I'm going to assume that the caller has assessed it for his own purposes and thinks that it is. And I think that as with anything, it depends on the questions that you're asking and who you're asking. You know, if the surveys are, you know, worded in such a way that the people who are taking them understand what they're being asked and respond in a way that, you know, is consonant with what the person who wrote the survey is trying to assess, you know, if the groups being surveyed are of a wide socioeconomic range and a wide, you know, have ethnic and racial diversity and live in rural and urban areas, you know, all these caveats, you know, there are, if those standards are met, then sure, you know, if you want to look at that data in that way, I think you can. I don't know. I don't know enough about this book to be able to speak on it specifically.
Yeah, we're going to have to leave it there. Rebecca, thanks a lot for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
That was Rebecca Onion, cultural historian at the University of Ohio and writer for Slate. Her piece on generational labels is linked on the Central Time Facebook page.